Hello again, Trippers. Alex Zane here, film journalist, movie fan, and your host for another glorious episode of A Trip to the Movies. Thank you for joining me today. I'm currently in our podcast studio a mile beneath the streets of London, and in a moment, my guest this week, Ghostbusters Frozen Empire director Gil Kenan, takes us all on his perfect trip to the movies. Thank you for downloading the podcast. This episode is brought to you by Odeon, because if you're going to watch a movie, it has to be at an Odeon Luxe. For me, there is no better place to experience the mesmerizing magic of the big screen. And when I say big, I mean crystal clear, four times sharper, larger than life, I sense big. A place where you can recline in luxury whilst sipping on your favourite tipple as you immerse yourself in the all-consuming power of the story, enriched by epic Dolby Atmos that'll make your spine tingle and the hairs on the back of your neck stand up. Now that is how to experience a movie, and there is no better feeling. You can book your Odeon Lux experience at odeon.co.uk or via the My Odeon app. Odeon say, we make movies better, and they're not wrong. Also, if you'd like to watch today's interview in glorious Technicolor, do head over to our YouTube channel, where the video goes up a few days after the pod. And for all the latest updates and to get in touch with us, you'll find us at Trip to Movies Pod. That's at Trip to Movies Pod on all social media. Right then, if you are ready, let's do this. Hello and welcome to the show, where each week a special guest takes us on their perfect trip to the movies. This week, we are joined by a brilliant writer and director. He began his big screen career with the wonderful Oscar-nominated animated film Monster House. Since his debut, he's directed 2015's Poltergeist, co-written 2021's Ghostbusters Afterlife, and directed that year's festive hit A Boy Called Christmas. Now, he's back in Spook Central, once again co-writing with Jason Reitman, but also taking on directing duties for Ghostbusters Frozen Empire out in cinemas this very day. Here to tell us about that film and take us on his perfect trip to the movies is the wonderful Gil Kenan. Gil, it is wonderful to see you again. As we record this, we are less than T-minus 24 hours till fans around the world get to see Frozen Empire. How are you feeling?
Geez, Alex, I was feeling pretty relaxed and looking forward to this conversation, but you started off with that grenade of a stress bomb. So now I'm on edge and, every word is a dagger leaving my lips.
A quick word to our Ghostbusters fans who are listening. This episode may contain a few spoilers, so if you haven't seen Frozen Empire yet, do go out and see it immediately, then listen. It is the 40th anniversary of the original film this year. What does it mean to you personally, Gil, to be directing the fourth film in the Ghostbusters canon this particular year?
It's incredibly meaningful, both because it's the 40th anniversary of my own relationship with Ghostbusters as a young film lover who went to go see the first film in a cinema at the tender age of 7. For me, that was a sort of gateway experience. It felt like there was me before seeing Ghostbusters and me after. That sort of feeling has never been lost on me, both in the writing of the previous film, Afterlife, and in writing with Jason Reitman and directing this film myself. There is obviously an incredible weight to the love and responsibility that I feel towards the characters and the fans. So everyone involved is putting so much of their own kind of spirit and heart into making a film like this. And I was sort of reminded of that in ways big and small throughout the making of the film, just how big this community of Ghostbusters fans is.
And I think one of your cast members, the brilliant Kumail Nanjiani, who's wonderful in the film, mentioned during the filming process, I think he was one of the first people to say that this was taking inspiration from the real Ghostbusters cartoon. Were there any particular episodes that you were inspired by from that cartoon?
Well, there were. I mean, again, it's been revealed in some of the in some of the material so far that Janine becoming a Ghostbuster was an image that we first saw in the series. I think the episode's called like Janine Melnitz is a Ghostbuster or something. And in that episode, she has to face off with a supernatural threat in her apartment, and she can't get the guys to believe her or show up. So she has to sort of take matters into her own hands. It's wild that it took so long for that to happen in the film series, but in a way that's very well deserved. You see it on the screen here. In a more broad sense, that show was inspiring in creating a sort of wild and liberal template for the mythology of the, especially the supernatural threats. And something like a frozen New York City, characters like Garaka, like Pukey, like the Possessor Ghost. I mean, all of them feel to me like elements that could have been in specific episodes of the real Ghostbusters. And that makes me happy because it suggests that there is a sort of freedom to explore beyond just the core kind of founding tenets of Ghostbusters in the Guzerian mythology with the Shandorian cult, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah, I mean, it was definitely a kind of a wind in our sails, that series.
You mentioned Janine becoming a Ghostbuster. I think Annie Potts said that she only found out during filming that she was actually going to become a Ghostbuster. Was that a planned surprise or a decision that was made later in the process?
Well, she's not totally innocent in this process because we did have a conversation at the very beginning when I called her to really introduce myself and invite her into this process. So much of this is for me as a relative newcomer to this world, especially compared to someone like Janine, Annie, who plays Janine, who's had a 40-year relationship with her character. I'm here first to listen and then to direct. And that's an important distinction because she had something she needed to say, which is that she felt like Janine should get more involved in the action. And that landed on me. It resonated. And Jason and I went back and developed a sort of deeper investment for her character in the action of the film. But even so, there was still this basic question that never got posed to me. And Alexis Forte, one of the two costume designers on the film, who did a brilliant job creating the costumes, came to me with... She loved asking a lot of questions every day. There was like this clipboard with basic questions, the sort of things you just have to answer but never think about while you're writing. And the question was, well, everyone else is getting suited up for this big battle, the siege. What's Janine going to be wearing? And I sort of answered without even really thinking about it. It just felt so natural that Janine needs to have a flight suit. And Alexis was like, I love it. Of course, we'll make her a flight suit. And I realized I'd never actually asked Annie about it. So I called Annie and said, I think Janine's going to be wearing a flight suit. And she was delighted. She was so happy. And you can see it on screen. I mean, there's so much joy and confidence. And she carries herself with so much pride, on it, especially once she's suited up. It makes me really happy as a fan.
It's a wonderful moment. There are certain things you obviously knew you were going to include in this film before you started writing the script. It was going to be in New York. There were going to be lots of ghosts. It was probably going to end with a Ray Parker Jr. song. But I think this is the first time in a Ghostbusters film we've had magic in the form of Kumail Nanjiani's character, Nadim. Was that a bold decision? Did you feel that was a big decision to make? And what was the thinking behind it?
Absolutely. I mean, I do think that we were conscientious of the fact that we were pushing in a direction that perhaps is not familiar territory for a Ghostbusters story. But it didn't feel alien to Ghostbusters. I mean, let's just, acknowledge that Ghostbusters has always had a kind of liberal application of the supernatural, both in the first and the second film. If you look at, you know, Mood Slime, for instance, in the second film and the way that it behaves, there is a supernatural verging on the magical quality that kind of runs like a ribbon through these stories. I think the important distinction is, and again, I'm going to be very careful not to get into territory that might diminish the experience for a fresh audience, but it's actually learning about the sort of historical context for magic in these stories and how it connects to maybe a deeper history to ghostbusting as a pursuit. And I think that's the part of it that felt thrilling as a fan to write, is that maybe this 1984 maybe wasn't the beginning of ghostbusting as we know it. And that felt like it sort of gave a framework to everything that happens with Nadim's character to sort of coexist happily in the world of Ghostbusters.
I would love to talk now about your brilliant big bad Garaka. He wouldn't look out of place in a Guillermo del Toro movie. How and when did you come up with him as your main antagonist?
It happened organically through the process of writing this film. I remember we knew the supernatural premise for this film very early on. I mean, we knew we would have a villain who could channel the sort of thermodynamic properties of fear and create something that would be all-consuming to the Ghostbusters and to the city they call home. But in starting to create the mythology for the character, I remember it was Jason who uttered the name Garaka for the first time. He pulled that name somewhere out of his brilliant Reitman mind. And I drew Garaka in the margins of our script while we were writing. And that initial sketch is very, very close to the character that you see on screen. It's a sort of representation of the kind of nightmarish specter that I've always wanted to see the Ghostbusters go up against and brought in. Because it's a creature, he's a sort of evil god who is able to harness human fear as a catalyst for destruction. It needed to be a character that had the hallmarks of pure nightmarish terror aesthetically. And that's where the long loping fingernails came from. That's where the sort of grotesque proportions came from. The sort of levitation, the slow staccato movement. And I have to say, even in the sort of directing and animation performance of the thing, I worked with Troy Saliba, a brilliant animation director who I worked with on Monster House actually way back when. And like in that previous collaboration, but even more pushed on this film, I used references going more to the sort of classic film monsters like Ray Harryhausen's Seven Voyage of Sinbad, moments to me that had a kind of staccato terror to the movement. And that was very much a kind of core direction and inspiration for this character.
I remember interviewing Jason, and I was asking him, going forward in the Ghostbusters universe, are there any filmmakers who he'd like to see tackle a Ghostbusters movie potentially? And he did mention Guillermo del Toro. But going forward, are there any filmmakers or actors you would particularly like to see be involved in a future Ghostbusters movie?
I feel like as a fan, there are so many people. I will say, I do feel like we used every actor in every funny actor in the world in this movie. I would love to see Ghostbusters become a world of storytelling where young directors can tell stories I would love for I would love to see a young woman tell a story in a Ghostbusters world. It feels like there is an energy and a point of view within that that can create a whole new path to energy and storytelling. Yeah, I'll think about it. But in my mind, it's a very inclusive world, and I think we've got space for tons of new voices in Ghostbusters.
One of the new faces in this movie is James Acaster, the brilliant stand-up, the British stand-up. And how did his casting come about in the film?
Well, I first of all, both Jason and I are fans of James's stand-up, and we had both independently seen him do his stand-up show. I saw him at the Soho Theater years ago, and you know, he's an absolute like brilliant presence on the stage. I actually worked with James on A Boy Called Christmas, the film that you and I met while I was promoting. He was one of the comedians who was brought in for me when I was leading the sort of comedy workshopping part of the screenplay before I went off to go shoot the film. And so it was a room full of brilliant young British comedians. And James stood out to me as a singular voice in that room. And we kept in touch. I've been a fan since. And both Jason and I saw in him potential beyond what he had been able to do up until that point. We felt like there was an actor in there. And my favorite part of watching James on screen, I think it's a really fresh and confident performance from him. I love feeling the moments between the moments where he feels like it's a proper grounded performance. And that makes me really happy because I you sort of see that and you realize this is somebody at the beginning of a film acting career. And you know he's going to go really far.
I saw the movie yesterday, and there's a great mid-credit sequence. But unlike Afterlife, there is no post-credit sequence. Obviously, at the end of Afterlife, we saw the Ecto-1 pulling into the firehouse and setting up the return to New York. What was the thinking behind the decision to have no post-credit sequence on Frozen Empire?
Well, the film ends with a sort of triumphant call to action. I mean, the door is definitely blown open into what the next few steps are. So it didn't feel like it needed another bit of narrative to tie up any loose ends. I mean, with Afterlife, the post-credit sequence was definitely a bridge being built between the story of the events of Somerville, Oklahoma, and a return back to New York City. In this story, we know now that the Ghostbusters have, without giving anything away, have a job to do. and that job is, you know, stretched out in every direction on screen in ways big and small.
I know you're a fan of London. You've spent time here before. I guess a little part of me was hoping there was going to be a London post-credit scene where the Ghostbusters moved to London. You love this city. This is an iconic city. Would you ever put the Ghostbusters in London, or is it always New York? It's their spiritual home, no pun intended.
I have so many answers to this question. First of all, I not only love London, it's my hometown. I was born in London. I live here. This is where I make my home. And not just that, but we filmed this movie, not in London proper, but in the greater Reading area. So very, very close to this city. And so when you ask, would I ever put Ghostbusters in London? I mean, I put them in London for months at a time while we were making this film. And it's not my fault you didn't get to see them running around with proton packs on in the streets. But the answer to your question about locale is we proved with Afterlife that you can tell a Ghostbusters story outside of the city. And in that film, obviously, there was a reason for it. It was to sort of rekindle the spark without the noise and without the trappings, both good and negative of a return to the home turf. Frozen Empire comes back to the city because it had to, because it's the home of Ghostbusters, and it's a story about a family searching for a home, or at least the definition of it, something that can sort of feel like a unifying, grounding presence. But I think that a Ghostbusters story is a story that is tied to character and tone more than to place. And it's wonderful that New York plays a character in this story. But just like characters can come and go within a storytelling universe, so can the location. And I think as long as you hold on to the sort of core principles of what makes a Ghostbuster story tick, then you can throw the dart anywhere on the world map and have an adventure.
Well, Gil, Ghostbusters Frozen Empire, it's on the big screen, the brilliant big screen, as this is released today. You have very kindly agreed now to leave this reality and enter a dimension of pure film where our virtual cinema awaits. You're our guide. We are your audience. Let's go on a trip to the movies. So we push open the doors to our temple of film and find ourselves in the foyer. There's an excited buzz, as there always is in a cinema foyer, the hum of anticipation. It's your perfect cinema trip, Gil. Who have you picked, living or dead, to go with you?
First of all, it's an honor to be joining you on this cinematic experience. And to bring with me into the theater, I have decided to invite a great historical character. I'd like to bring with me Abraham Lincoln. And there's a few reasons. One is because he seemed like a cool dude to bring into a movie theater. It was probably hard for him. He was very tall. And I imagine that, I think this is a private showing, at least in my mind, that we're the only two people in the movie theater. I think normally he would have to slouch down because, you know, the hat and the height, he probably would create a bit of a disturbance. I don't like sitting in the back row. So this would be something where he would have a little bit more of a comfortable time. But primarily, it's because I think the guy deserves a satisfying time in a theater. I think that he has historically been tied to the worst possible experience in a theater. And I'd like to give the guy, I'd like to let him see the end of a story.
I love it. Abraham Lincoln. As we're talking about history, I will say Frozen Empire opens with an incredible scene set in 1904 New York. The first time I think a Ghostbusters film has flashed back to history. I think I'm right on that. How big a decision was that for you? And what made you decide to do that?
It was so fun. And we knew that we were going to develop a bit of the backstory, the mythology of this ancient artifact that was going to be an important driver in the narrative. The specific choice to go there and then was connected to actually my wedding way back when. I got married at a place in New York City that was called the Explorers Club. It's still there. And it was an old, almost like a British style kind of gentleman's club, but one specifically rooted in gentlemen adventurers who would come back from their exploits around the world with some sort of artifact. And then they would sit around kind of in a clubby way, you know, with brandy in their hand, and somebody would hold court and talk about the whale penis that they dragged back from Antarctica. And so this place was like this kind of a extraordinary feast for the eyes. It's full of stuffed animals and rare artifacts, shrunken heads and little jars of teeth and stuff. It's amazing and cool and elegant and interesting, and is connected to a version of the past that we don't really get to engage with very often. And it just felt like such a perfect setting for the start of this story.
It's great. It's a great opening to the movie. Okay. So we're going with Abraham Lincoln. There's a clock on the wall in the foyer. It reads a specific time. What time of day have we gone to the cinema, Gil?
So this is something that in my movie going life, I don't get to do enough. I love a morning movie. I love a morning matinee screening. I actually, I think this is controversial. I love that feeling of sun. Remember, I grew up in Los Angeles, so we have a relationship with a bright thing in the sky that shines sometimes. That feeling of the sun kind of in your eyes as you come out of a movie and you still have an entire day ahead of you to think about the film, talk about it, process it. And my wife hates a morning film screening. She loves a nighttime screening. So I think this is because this is a dream, you know, scenario for me. And because it's only Abraham Lincoln I have to worry about, he probably has, you know, a really busy schedule for the rest of the day. I think that this will give both of us that thing we're looking for.
All right. I'm sending you and Abraham Lincoln to a morning screening. Now, you very kindly booked the tickets for this trip. Which seats in the auditorium are we going to be sitting?
So I've had now, I guess, a 30-year relationship with working on movies, going from being an intern and a PA to now writing and directing them. I haven't wavered from the middle back center of a cinema from the very first days of falling in love with movies as a kid through to working on them and now to mixing and making them. It's been verified by all the engineers I've ever worked with that those are the primo spots for sort of full sound immersion. I don't like the mix to feel too left or right justified. I don't want to feel like I'm losing treble or bass. I'm a sucker for a completely, you know, balanced experience. And so for me, it's the golden zone, the middle back center of the cinema.
If I'd had to put money on it, I would have said you would pick those seats. They're the most popular seats on the show. I'm putting you right there. The final thing we need before we leave the foyer, the air is full of wonderful smells. All manner of snacks and foodstuffs are available at the various counters. What are you choosing to eat?
So, you know, not to ruffle any feathers, and I haven't checked with Abe to see how peckish he is, but I'm not a huge fan. I'm not a huge eater during movies. I love to have a beverage. And actually, maybe if I'm being totally honest with you, my favorite thing to eat during a theatrical cinematic experience is the ice at the bottom of my Diet Coke or, you know, Coke Zero or whatever. It's sort of, keeps my mouth refreshed. it doesn't make my fingers all oily. I like a bit of popcorn. I'll never say no to a little bit of popcorn. And when I eat it, I know this country has this savory sweet thing. I'm not a fan. For me, popcorn is always the classic American sort of salty popcorn, although with no butter whatsoever. So if Abraham Lincoln is getting some popcorn and he's nice enough to share, I'm not going to say no. I'm not going to make him feel awkward that he's going to eat all of this stuff while I'm sitting there, you know, judging him with my a mouthful of ice. Somewhere between those two, what I don't want is for Abraham Lincoln to like get a hot dog or a pizza during the movie, because nobody wants to be sitting next to the person eating a hot dog in a movie theater. It's just not. Do it in shame, standing outside in the hallway. Don't do it as you come inside.
Lovely. All right, then. It is a huge Coke Zero Diet Coke, but with lots of ice for you to crunch on throughout the film. Let's leave the foyer. We push open the door to the corridor that leads to the auditorium. Now, it's looking quite bare at the moment, so I'm going to put up some posters that illustrate some of your most important movie memories. And the first poster, Gil, depicts your fondest movie memory.
Well, it's funny because when you just said that, when you just asked that, I saw a different poster than my favorite movie memory. So I'd like to take a little walk on my way to my favorite movie memory poster if I can mess with the format for a second and just say that the first thing I saw was the poster for Gremlins, actually, which was such a captivating teaser image. It was a box being held by a young man, and the box was just slightly askew, and a bit of light was coming out of it, and a little hand sort of sticking out of the box. And it had that sort of quality of suggesting tone and mystery and made me lean in. But I walk confidently past that poster to a poster that depicts an experience that for me was a really important one. Interestingly, like this one, in an empty movie theater, the cinema was totally empty. My father took me to see Time Bandits, and it was in its first run showing. I was quite young for it, but it also was like a total breakthrough for me in terms of an experience watching a film. I felt completely transported. And it was actually the first time where, as a movie ended, I sat in my place. I didn't want to get up. I wanted to watch the names that played after the film. And I remember that actually being, it was probably because I wanted to see who the hell was responsible for what I just watched, but also because I was a little bit struck dumb by the experience. I just felt overwhelmed. And I needed a few moments sitting there to just process what I had gone through. I remember in that space after the film ended and before I got up and walked out with my dad, thinking that there was someone behind the making of this film. And it was a thought I had never had before. Movies, when you're a kid, are just these like kind of complete experiences that you're plumped down in front of and you watch and they pass through your eyes and then you go on to the next thing. And this was one where I felt like it was singular enough where there was a person who made it. And I think that's probably the seed that planted in my brain that eventually led to me wanting to be a storyteller myself.
Well, that's a great fond memory. I'm putting up a poster for Time Bandits. Did the ending not screw with you a bit? I remember the ending where his parents explode and then it just ends.
Loved it. I feel like it was like just perfect Roald Dahl tone, you know, of like just doing the most violent and catastrophic turn to remind you that you're not going back to a coddled life where everything will be the same as it was before you entered. No, nobody is safe. The ground under you can be pulled out. I loved that sort of twist of the knife at the end of the film.
Oh, okay. Well, it messed me up a bit, but your first movie poster, your fondest movie memory is for Time Bandits. The second poster depicts, Gil, your worst movie memory.
Well, worst is maybe a strong word for what was actually just like a kind of literally catastrophic experience, because I love the movie. Just want to qualify that this is a movie that I genuinely love in every direction. The film is Beetlejuice, and I went to go see it on my own, which is something I had started to do. I think I became more interested in movies or more hungry to see them than I, you know, I couldn't always inspire my whole family to go with me. So this was one where I got dropped off at the theater and went in to see Beetlejuice. And it was a sort of daytime, afternoon, midweek screening. So not packed. There were maybe 15 or 20 of us in the theater. It was at the Man Valley West Theater on Ventura Boulevard in the San Fernando Valley where I grew up. And again, I remember where I was sitting. It wasn't dead center, middle back. It was a little bit to the right of that, closer to the back of the theater. And halfway through the film, there was a rumble that began. And sometimes movies have, you know, deep bass and you expect there's going to be some vibration. But this rumble didn't end. It built and grew and grew. And all of a sudden, the entire theater started to shake. And because this was Los Angeles and we were living in the San Fernando Valley, very quickly, we realized what was happening. Somebody yelled earthquake. And we all got up and ran out of the emergency doors of the movie theater. And so literally, my very first experience with Beetlejuice involved an act of God that forced me out of the theater. And then we waited outside for a couple of minutes. The earthquake ended, and then we went back in. The movie never rewound or anything. So my first experience missed a couple of minutes of the film, but in subsequent viewings, I was able to fill in the blanks.
All right, then. We're putting up a poster for Beetlejuice as, an earthquake-fueled worst movie memory. And the next poster is, Gil, your unpopular movie opinion.
Well, I think, I wonder how unpopular this is. I think among certain circles of the people who we engage with day to day, this might be something that feels like passe, or it was a fad that has gone away. But I'm a secret sucker for a 3D movie experience. I love putting on glasses and feeling like something special is happening in the cinema. And I know that this was the sort of trend that built up in big ways around the release of Avatar. But my first movie, Monster House, I got to make a 3D release of it, and I loved that experience. And I've gotten to do it a couple of other times in my career. Each time, the experience of making and fine-tuning a 3D experience is like super satisfying. It's so fun as somebody who loves the way that a camera moves through space to feel that space a little bit more viscerally. And I think it's maybe a selfish love. I don't really care about how other people feel about it. I bet it would blow Abraham Lincoln's fucking mind to see a movie in 3D though. Can you imagine if he's like, what are we watching? I'd be like, just be quiet, put these glasses on. And then the movie starts, and just like, imagine Abraham Lincoln watching Avatar for the first time. Like, I would give anything to be able to be the dude who's sitting next to him while he's freaking out. It would be weirder for him than like getting shot in the back of the head, I think. It would be like a genuinely, life-altering experience.
Lovely. That is your unpopular movie opinion poster, that 3D movies are actually much better than people give them credit for. And we're leaving the corridor. We enter the auditorium. Now, there are a couple of things I want to play on the big screen before we get to the movie you've chosen to screen for us. And the first thing is a trailer for the film you're most looking forward to seeing at the cinema.
Okay. Can I do two trailers? I'm just going to do two anyway.
All right.
One I've seen already. It's Furiosa, and I've gotten a chance to see it on a big screen a couple of times, and it just feels like exactly the George Miller experience I want. I want him to keep making bananas big screen spectacles. So Furiosa is the real one. The one I'm also just super looking forward to as a film fan. I don't know anything about the movie, but the new PTA film, it's always an event for me, and I can't wait to see what he's cooking.
All right. Well, you didn't give me an option, but you played two trailers, so that's fine. You had to. Okay. So let's play a moment from cinema. And the moment I want to play from cinema is the movie moment that makes you literally or metaphorically, Gil, pump your fist in the air.
It's always the moment when Daniel in The Karate Kid overcomes both his internal obstacles, his self-doubt, his searching for character and a path forward, and the external forces, the uncalled for leg sweep that almost cost him his ability to stand on two feet, and executes a flawless crane kick. That is a moment I'll never forget experiencing for the first time in a movie theater. It's the ultimate fist pump moment. If you haven't heard that answer before on your show, then there's something very wrong with all of your guests. If anybody else has said it, then they got the right answer.
It has come up before. It is a favorite, especially for people of our generation. But yes, it's a great answer. All right. Conversely, then, let's play what you consider cinema's most shocking moment, Gil.
Well, this is another moment. I always sort of think back to where I was sitting in a movie theater when these moments happen. I saw Lars von Trier's Dancer in the Dark in a small cinema house in West Los Angeles. And the moment when Bjork's character I don't think we have to worry about spoiling Dancer in the Dark now, right? The moment when Bjork's character is executed at the end of that film was a visceral gut punch to an entire movie house. I've never experienced anything like it. I've never felt a communal sense of loss in that way in a movie theater. And because the movie ends very shortly thereafter, there was a emotional outpouring that I have also never experienced before. People were ugly crying. And this was an experience where people were sitting down in their seats during the credits, not because they wanted to read the names, but because everyone was collecting themselves. And it was almost like a support group. People were sort of clinging to one another, holding on to each other, and just finding the will to use their legs to stand up, to walk out to their miserable lives again. And so that has to be the moment.
All right. We're playing that moment from Dancer in the Dark. And the final question before we get to the movie you are screening for us tonight is, what is the best use of music in a movie for you, Gil?
It's one that I turn back to more often than anything else. Okay, I'm gonna give an honorary mention to something that I love, and then I'm gonna tell you the piece of music that I actually listen to the most from movies, because it's an extraordinary visceral experience for me. The honorary mention is more than honorary. It's legendary. It's Wendy Carlos's score for A Clockwork Orange. I feel like you can't hear that music without picturing the film's imagery. Absolutely a perfect marriage of sight and sound. The film music that actually for me is the one that works best to support the narrative, and that I listen to more than any other piece of film music, is Pino Donaggio's score for Carrie, and specifically the homecoming after the prom. I think that he found a way to create a sort of operatic stage for the emotional tragedy that Carrie encountered amongst her peers. And when she walks back into that house, there is a piece of music. It sounds like Mellotron. It might be other instruments, but there's definitely a sort of, you know, wonderful synthetic, vintage synthetic quality to it. It's an extraordinary piece of music. It's, you know, if you played that at my funeral, I'd be fine with it. So that's the piece of music I'm going to choose.
I certainly was never able to listen to the William Tell overture in quite the same way after watching Clockwork Orange. Right. We have arrived. It is time now to announce to Abraham Lincoln in this auditorium the movie out of all others, Gil, you have picked to screen for us tonight. Gil, what are we watching?
Okay, guys, this is not something I would put up for a big populist group of audience members, but it's a movie that's been meaningful to me for years. And let's be honest. So it's a movie from the past. I'll tell you what it is in a second. I'm just going to give a little bit of context for it. It's a post-war film from France, 1946, just after the end of the Second World War. But of course, for Abraham Lincoln, that's not going to make any difference. It'll still be magical moving images. How is this happening? Where is this sound coming from? For him, it'll feel like the balance between Avatar and this movie I'm about to talk about is just as mind blowing. I shouldn't use the word mind blowing when talking about Abraham Lincoln, but you know, it's implied. The film was one that was front and center for me in one particular thematic thread of the making of Ghostbusters: Frozen Empire. Not to be audacious in my plugging of the film once again at the closing moments of our conversation, but it actually was a piece of film that I shared with the actress, Emily Allen Lind, who plays a significant ghost character in this film. And anyone who sees this film will see that for the first time in a Ghostbusters film, we have a ghost with a story to tell. And it's a film called Sylvie and the Phantom, Sylvie and the Ghost, Sylvie et la Phantom in French. And it's a love story between a ghost who has been trapped in a painting for ages. And he emerges from his painting with his delightful little French dog every night to wander the halls of his old house. And what we learn is that this ghost, the man behind the ghost, lost his life in a duel for the honor of loving a young woman. And the tragic love story at the center of this film is that this ghost emerges, and one day he encounters something that takes his breath away. It's this woman just as he remembers her all those years ago when he lost his life, but it happens to be the granddaughter of that woman who is now visiting this same home where her grandmother once lived. And so this ghost, who moves so beautifully through this world, and it would come as no surprise to learn that this was Jacques Tati's very first film performance, and the playfulness, the physicality was all completely inspirational in this film. And there's a moment where Melody moves down one of the fire poles of the firehouse. That moment and the one after it where she goes through a floor and disappears through it are direct visual allusions to Sylvie and the Ghost. Also, the score of that film was a critical piece of music that I played for Dario Marinelli, who scored Frozen Empire, and creating a sort of lyrical emotionality. So nobody cares about that. It's a great movie. And again, for Abraham Lincoln, I think he's a pretty easy audience. Let's be honest. We could have played like two kittens batting a ball of yarn, and it would have been his greatest cinematic experience of his life. But for me, it's meaningful, and it's my movie theater today, so that's what I'm going to show.
Gil, the curtains are closing on 1946's Sylvie and the Ghost. Abraham Lincoln and you're walking out. He's smiling, he's chatting, he's thanking you on taking him to this magical room where moving pictures come to life. The taxi has arrived to ferry you back to reality, but we do have a mystery question from one of our listeners. It's called What's in the Box? Here is your question.
I saw you with the box. What was in the box?
What's in the box?
So this is from a Ghostbusters fan who listens to the show. What is the current status of the Netflix animated Ghostbusters series?
It's very exciting. I just watched an entire art presentation for the show. I've seen the sets, the environments, and I just saw my first glimpse at a world of supernatural characters as realized by our brilliant creative team. All I can say is the work is being done as we speak. It's in what we call full development. Scripts are being written. Art is being created. It's a great time to be a Ghostbuster.
Amazing news. Gil, that is us done. As I said, your taxi has arrived to ferry you back to reality. But before you go, Gil, let's recap your perfect trip to the movies. You are going with Abraham Lincoln in the morning. You are sitting at the middle, just slightly towards the back, because that is factually where the perfect sound in an auditorium is found. You are not a big movie eater, so you are merely having a large Coke Zero full of as much ice as you could ever want to crunch on throughout the film. We are then entering the corridor and putting up a poster for your fondest movie memory. It was almost the poster for Gremlins, but then we went for Time Bandits as the reason you wanted to become a storyteller. The second poster depicts your worst movie memory, and that was experiencing an earthquake during Beetlejuice. The next poster is your unpopular movie opinion, and it is that you are a fan of 3D films. We enter the auditorium. You are playing a trailer for both Furiosa, because you always want George Miller to carry on making bananas movies, and the new Paul Thomas Anderson film. The movie moment that makes you literally or metaphorically pump your fist in the air is that final fight, the crane kick at the end of Karate Kid. The moment you consider cinema's most shocking is the end of 2000's Lars von Trier Bjork-starring movie, Dancer in the Dark. And the best use of music in the movies is the work of Wendy Carlos on A Clockwork Orange. And finally, Gil, the movie you are screening for us is 1946's Sylvie and the Ghost, which actually inspired Ghostbusters Frozen Empire. Gil, thank you for taking us on a trip to the movies. All that remains for me to do is say, Gil Kenan, have you had a good time?
I've had the best time. And can we just take one more moment to acknowledge that even the taxi pulling up would be like an experience for Abraham Lincoln? Just like how far we've come as a society. And he's just watched 3D for the first time. He just watched a ghost move around. I think that I've had a good time, but I think I can confidently say Abraham Lincoln's never going to forget this day.
I think you're absolutely right. It's been a pleasure chatting with you, Gil. I'll say goodbye. And as Gil's cab carries him out of this dimension, away from our virtual cinema, back to reality, we must all leave his movie paradise as well. But before I say my final farewell for this episode, don't forget, you can find the full video for today's Gil Kenan interview, and indeed for every guest, over on our Trip to the Movies YouTube channel. So do please head over there. And as I said at the start, if you like what you see, please hit subscribe and help us grow the pod. And that really is it. I'll be back next week when another guest fills our cinema with their celluloid dreams as they take us on a trip to the movies. Bye-bye.